Welcome to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com.
I'm here today with the Premier of Bermuda, Michael Dunkley. Premier, thank you very much for carving out some time in what is obviously a very hectic schedule for you. I'd like to touch a little bit on the throne speech 2015 and then move on perhaps to some other subjects. I know you're quite tight for time, so hopefully we'll get through some of the questions. 2013, I was reading the throne speech of 2013 yesterday, and there was a quote in it that said, "Government's operating vision was to achieve social and economic recovery for all Bermudians, leaving no one behind." 2 years on, how do you think you're doing in that regard?
Well, Jeremy, first, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Any opportunity I get to talk to the media and to the wider public, it's one that I really cherish. So it's good to be here and talking to you.
Thank you.
2 years on, I'd have to, guess, put it in a very simple term, that we are on the road of progress, but it's taken some time to make the progress. I think against the backdrop of that is that we were aware just how deep-rooted some of the challenges were that we face.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes some time to make some progress in those. I think one of the things that is frustrating for people and also, I think, for legislators is the time it takes to do things. But once you realize what actually is involved in any position that you try to move forward, then you understand that the time always moves very quickly when you're trying to get some things done. So we're making progress, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
If you could give yourself a mark out of 10?
I don't like to judge myself, because you're only as good as you are yesterday. Today is a new day. It's a new slate. You've got to move forward. You've got to do what you have to do.
You mentioned the pace.
And certainly when I was graded in school, my marks weren't that high. So I'd be a tough judge. But
me too. I could always do better than that.
Well, I remember when I came home from school, in those days you get in the car and the first thing your mother would say to you is, "Can I have your report card?" And I said, "I think I left it in school." But definitely we get a strong passing grade. But there's a lot of work to be done. So it's like calculus in math. It was always calculus 1, 2, 3, and 4. We're probably on calculus 2.5 now, going to 3.
You mentioned the pace of change. You've mentioned it's not as fast, perhaps, as you'd like it to be. What are the reasons for that?
Just because of the deep-rooted challenges that we faced in two main areas. The economy was in a real, real difficult position.
I'm going to come on to that.
After a number of years of downturn, no one really knew where the bottom was. And then secondly, government finances.
Right.
And I think the third thing that needs to be drawn into this is how the world's changed. We live in a world that now changes more rapidly than it did last year, and that pace of change is never going to stop. And what that means is that every country has their own set of problems, and because we live in a smaller world where the pace of change is so quickly, countries are more demanding on other countries outside, so you're under a more difficult microscope. So we've seen in the banking industry, in the reinsurance industry, in all the areas where we have some good strength and are part of our economy, the bar is raised because of more oversight. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it makes it much harder for you to get your job done. Compliance people are the way of the world now.
But that's external influences. Are there any internal influences that are slowing down the pace of change? For instance, I have spoken to politicians since I've been here during my career who have been frustrated with the civil service, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I think that's an easy excuse to make. I'm not that type of person. Why? Because people make the world go round. And in any organization, you have stellar people who you can count on to do everything, and you have other people that you have to change and move forward. In the business that I ran until I got in the position full-time, I had those same challenges. I've been blessed to work with some great civil servants. I've seen some that, we need to change the way we go. So I'm not going to blame the civil service. We're all in this together. Leaders find a way to make change happen, and that's what we're doing.
You quite boldly announced that the Great Recession, as you called it, was over. Is it over?
Well, I don't think it's as bold as most people suggested. And a number of people said that since I made that comment, I believe it was just a couple of days ago on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it is over because all the economic indicators that we use as measurable conclusions to something like that show that it's going up. Now, remember, we were going down for so long. Mm-hmm. Now the indicator is going another way. It doesn't mean we're in the position where we need to be.
No. But
clearly, when you have GDP increasing for three quarters, when you have the unemployment rate for the first time drop, when you have retail sales going up for 12 months in a row now, those are indicators that, yeah, you're not in that recession. And that's backed up by what the finance minister has said.
Sure.
And, you know, what some economists have said.
But you mentioned the unemployment rate. Yeah, it's gone down from 9% to 7%. But that kind of masks the fact that there's still something like 23% youth unemployment. We see stories every day about charities, almost every day, about charities facing the threat of closure. There was a story about how parents couldn't afford school uniforms. Do you think the recession really is beginning to be over for a few and not the majority?
As my comments have been on record all week, that I believe the recession's over, but there's still a lot of people that are not part of that yet. In the press conference we had on Monday, I made it very clear that our work now is more focused on ever than helping the vulnerable, helping those people that haven't got a job or are struggling with what they have to do. You know, I know that they are still in a very weak position. There's too many of those people out there.
There's a lot of them, yeah.
You know, I don't like to beat our chest and say the recession's over, because we still have a lot of work.
But you did say the recession's over.
But that's a fact. It's a fact.
For some.
No, it's a fact. It's a fact. In no matter what economy you're in, even in the best economy in the world, you're still going to have people struggling. In our economy now, there are too many people are struggling. And I'll work all day today and wake up tomorrow and do the same thing again, roll up our sleeves, because there are too many Bermudians that are struggling, and we'll make that happen now. Look, youth unemployment has dropped to 23%.
From 29%.
But it was over 30% before, right? And you know, we still have a lot of work to do with young people, because when you see that youth unemployment rate, and when you see the challenges we have with gangs, we still have a lot of work to do there. Yes, we know charities have a problem, because when you have tough times, people look much more closely at how mm-hmm. they're going to spend their money, and charities are the first to struggle.
Absolutely.
So I'm not saying that the good days are here again. I'm not saying that. But we're going in the right direction. And I believe every week, every month, we'll still get stronger, because our policies are working. Confidence is coming back into the community. There's more and more opportunity than there used to be. But we do live in a much more complicated society. Coming out of this recession, the whole model for business has changed. I've said it again, and I'll say it for you and the people who will listen to this, is in recessions of days gone by, when businesses saw that things were starting to turn, the first thing they geared up was to take advantage of the turn in opportunity. And one of the first things they did was get more people in the door to work for them, because that's what they needed. But nowadays, the model's changed. They get the business first, and the staff are the last to get
into. I was going to say, because there was a recent survey which showed the businesses were confident in the future of the economy and probably felt the recession was over, but they were saying, but personally, we're not that confident yet, and we're not going to take staff on. Do you think that this is heading towards a sort of enlarged two-tier society? Is there a danger in that, the haves and the have-nots? To use a very, quite nasty phrase, I suppose, but it sums it up. Do you think there's a danger of that in Bermuda at the moment, or do you think those in the lower tier, the jobless, the low-paid, underemployed, are going to catch up quickly?
Well, I think any time you've had a prolonged period of recession like we've had, that exaggeration is there even more than it was before. And so our work now in government has to be to deal with the people who are really struggling. As the recession starts to turn, there's opportunity out there for people. We need to pull the most vulnerable people in our society along to make it happen. So what you refer to just doesn't take place.
Mm. But at the same time, it's just bit of a vicious circle, because we have got the charities who say they can't afford to take people on or help people, and they generally support the most vulnerable people in society. It just seems to be a bit of a vicious circle at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, life can unfortunately be like that. And, a very common saying is that history repeats itself. You've got to learn from the lessons of the past and try not to repeat the things that are not worth it. But look, there are a lot of charities in Bermuda who perform great work and much needed work. One of the things that I've been most surprised at in my time sitting around the cabinet table is the breadth of charities we have,
mm.
and quite often the duplication of work. So you have hard-earned dollars that people are giving to go into charities. With the duplication of work, the resources are really not getting to the critical need point that they need to do. So
yes.
one of the things we try to do through Minister Faye is to make sure that charities operate in an open and transparent way and to make sure there's accountability for their money. And as a government, we're going to try to bring some of those helping charities together so they can work more efficiently. And then the dollars we have will be spent and
sure.
get a higher higher performance for the most vulnerable in our society.
Reading the throne speech through the years, I read 2014 yesterday as well, and there has been an emphasis, almost totally actually, on international business, to use an umbrella term, and tourism. It's what I would term the reliance on the usual suspects, I suppose. What else has government been looking at? It's a holy grail, the third pillar, has been for years. But it seems in the recession to be more onus, perhaps, on creating that third pillar. What sort of things have government been looking at?
Well, I'll answer that in two sections. The first part of that answer is the because of the strength of international business and the opportunity in international business, I think you have to continue to focus in on that. And we've seen in the past couple of years with ILS, we've become the dominant player in that industry now. And there is opportunity there. We've seen with some of the changes of oversight, certainly insolvency, that the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Economic Development believe that there is increased opportunity in Bermuda mm-hmm. now because of our acceptance at those tiers, and I support that. So when you've got your main pillar, you've got to shore it up and you've got to look for more opportunity. We're going to do that.
Understand.
And that's critically important with tourism. I think everyone in Bermuda knows the downturn in tourism that we face. There is a tremendous upside in tourism for us, not only for, as I gave the speech to the BTA summit on Monday, not only because what it does to our economy, but the potential to get Bermudians involved. You know, hospitality is in our DNA.
Yeah.
The potential to get Bermudian involved and the upside of it is important. I think over the next, certainly in 2016 and 17, we have some unique opportunities all across the board in tourism, which I believe now, as we sit here in November of 2015, we're in a much better position to capitalize on that with increased airlift, with the facilities being upgraded, with new facilities about to take place, and construction opportunities for Bermudians.
Sure.
And the last part of that, because I know you've got something else on the tip of your tongue, a third pillar or a new source of investment and revenue in the community is something we have paid attention to. Certainly in the energy sector, there's a lot of opportunity there. So we're continuing to investigate these type of things. But as you know, Jeremy, nothing comes quickly overnight. And certainly good sources of revenue, no matter if it's business or government taxes or whatever, takes time to set up and do in the appropriate way. So I think mm-hmm. We've got a real three track is to make sure our international business continues to grow, make sure we improve tourism, and that's a critical thing, and the third track is new opportunities, and we're investigating all of those.
Just international business clearly is extremely important. It is extremely important for balance of payments, but in terms of actual employment, it's not a massive amount.
I disagree with that.
Really?
I don't have the numbers at the tip of my tongue, but directly employed in international business, there are a few thousand employees.
A few thousand,
A few thousand. That's a good number.
Out of a workforce of?
I don't have the exact number of the workforce now, but probably, let's say 30%, like 30,000, I could be, I could be out by 10% either way.
But it's a good estimate. So
no, but it's a significant portion of our workforce.
Yes.
But when you put in all the people that are impacted by international business
yes.
and their add-on, international business, in my opinion, touches on the vast majority in our community.
That's my point, because you're right. It does touch on a huge amount of people with all the service industries that go around it. It seems to me that it's the service industries and the small industries that need to be grown as much as well as looking after international business and tourism. And it seems to me that it's got to be bricks and mortar, the third pillar. It can't just be a feel-good thing. It can't just be bringing more IB in, so we rely on IB even more. We rely on tourism even more. We've seen through the recession the fact that we relied so heavily on two people, and it had a marked effect. Two industries.
Yeah, but any time you have a recession, everybody's going to feel the pain, and everyone felt the pain in that. During deep recessions like we had, starting in 2007, and just coming to conclusion now, there's no one escapes unharmed about it, and especially businesses who stay at the cutting edge of what happens. They make their decisions. They see things coming, and they make their decisions from that. I don't disagree with you. The driver of a recovery is going to be small business.
Mm-hmm.
New roots that are springing mm-hmm. up and showing the green shoots above the ground, that's going to be it. But that driver, those small business, they can come with an increase in international business. They will come with turnaround in tourism, and they will come with some of these new industries that are going for. Just look at the change in the energy sector. I mean, look, one small thing, look at the solar policy. Oh,
absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually putting solar panels in my house now, mm-hmm. where 5 years ago when I looked at it, it just wasn't, as an investment, it wasn't economically feasible. But now it is. Within 4 years, I can get a return on my investment.
Sure.
And that's a small business that started up, and they're booming now because of that. So
it's finite, of course.
Small business will be the driver of it, but I think all of the industries that get growth in Bermuda and the new industries that come, there'll be small business to take an opportunity from. Now, the America's Cup is the same thing as
well. It has the potential, yeah.
Because there's a lot of small business we see that has sprung up from there. We saw mm-hmm. it on Front Street for the Louis Vuitton.
Totally agree. Yeah. Those things are quite finite, though. I mean, there's only so many roofs you can put solar panels on, for instance. The AC is going to
scratch the surface.
But the AC is only going to be here in 2017. One of the things I was talking to Mike Winfield about with the AC legacy was whether it's going to be bricks and mortar that attracts new money into Bermuda. And it seems to me that, that's the necessity at the moment. New businesses, new ideas, out-of-the-box thinking that attracts investment into Bermuda. Therefore, it's probably more sustainable.
Good point. And that's happening. I think the AC has given us a bit of a catapult with them being here and what needs to get done to get ready for that. But also, people realize it's a great time to actually make an investment because you can get an early start at paying off your investment by the AC being here. And I think that the AC legacy is going to be very sustainable because if you look at simply what's happening in the dockyard, that was a plan that pretty much was written down and we were going to start to move forward. The AC allowed it to be jump-started.
Mm.
And so the Event Village, when that's finished, that's going to be a great opportunity not only for government to capitalize on with some of the services they offer, but for private sector to get involved in that.
Just moving on, a couple of things that stood out to me in the Friend speech, which haven't really been touched on that much, I don't think, is that you said the government is going to look at whether pension contributions are set at appropriate levels. In my experience, certainly in my personal experience, pensions are rarely set at appropriate levels. I certainly could be doing to increase my pension contributions. Should we be concerned, perhaps, that pension contributions will be increased?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I tend to look at it in a different way. Pensions are, in my humble opinion, something that has really only been focused on for the last 30 years. I mean, we only put the private pension scheme in probably in the late 1990s.
Mm.
I remember the legislation at the time. Before that, there was just the government one, the social insurance. And most people didn't even think about a pension. And now, people think about a pension for many reasons. I think they live longer. The quality of life is much better as you get older because of medication and lifestyles and things like that. So pension is an important part of it. I think it's prudent for us to take a look at pensions to see how we can make funds sustainable and how we can improve the pension ability for all the people, whether it's the government pension or the private pension fund. And I think the discussion about that's healthy so people get a better understanding because I don't think anybody should rely solely on a pension. If you do that, then I just don't think you can live solely on a pension.
No.
And that's the misinformation that some people take. So I think it's going to be a good, healthy review that has to be taking place. And it's something we have to pay attention to. There's a lot of pension funds that are struggling.
Including governments.
Yeah.
Is this review going to look at government's pension funds?
The Minister of Finance is in a better position to give more detail on
because that's one of the very big black holes, isn't it, in government funding at the moment.
But I think we've made some moves. And, you know, I think it would be appropriate for you to sit down with the Minister of Finance and talk about it in more detail. But I think we've made some early steps to shore up those funds, and we'll continue to do that.
See, one of the reasons I asked that, and you touched on it, is that small businesses. I'm a small business, and it's quite onerous for me to have to pay my pension. I do, but it's quite onerous to me. And, you know, if you're looking at increases in pension contributions, it's going to have a significant effect on small business. And they are the majority employer here.
Yes. But one of the things that we've always endeavored to do as a government is make sure that as we make changes and consider changes, that we communicate with people. And we'll continue to do this.
Right. Because this is a crucial issue, the ageing population. Mm-hmm. Every government has got to tackle this about pensions. Mm-hmm. Because the government doesn't want to be left with a bill, basically.
No.
Is that really the crux of this review?
No, I don't think so. I think it's to make sure that our society is in a better position going forward. I mean, we recognize that it's an aging population, and those trends are right in front of us. You have to deal with it.
In the last budget, the finance minister did mention that there were going to be a review of the taxation system here. And I noticed that that report, I believe, has been done. And it's going for review by, I'm not exactly sure who, but by peers in the Caribbean, I think. Is there anything you can tell me you can rule in or out? We're going to look at VAT, or where should be probably sales tax here?
I can't make any further comment at this time. I'm aware that we've had the review. I've had some initial summary discussions with the Minister of Finance just to give me an idea of what was presented. But the Minister of Finance is working through that. I can assure you and everyone that by the budget time, there'll be more substantive information coming out. There are two very important public documents that come out through the year, which set the agenda for legislation, so the throne speech last Friday, and then the budget debate in February. And so I'll leave that for the Minister of Finance to give the real broad, detailed overview that he has shown that he will do.
Are you tempted by the corporate tax? It's a huge temptation, must be.
Yeah, I'm 57 years old, so my temptation is, I manage to temper it where it has to be. We communicate with all our partners in this, and so as we go through these changes, you can recall, Jeremy, what happened with international business when the payroll tax was increased by 2% without communication, the real challenges it caused us. And the U-turn. So we're going to live and learn from communication. And we spend a lot of time with our partners. And so we build that strength. So it's premature to even speculate on those things until we've worked further down the road.
Fair enough. There are a few other issues I'd like to touch on now, really. One that you're well aware of has been in the news recently, last few days, and was subject, I think, to a 300-page report, the Auditor General's report, which, scathing is probably an appropriate word, of spending, accountability, transparency over the last few years prior to your government, obviously. I've suggested... Is there a feeling amongst the OBA, amongst the government, to follow the money trail, to try and follow the money trail, to see what went wrong, and to try and see if there's any accountability or people that can be held accountable for what looks like misspending?
That's a very good question. I think over the history that I'm aware of auditors' reports, that they always make quite a splash.
Mm. Well, they're always pretty shocking.
Yeah, and you know, I think the former government has marked up a record where there's always been some interesting reading in them. So I look at it in two ways. One, as the premier, I have the responsibility to look at it to make sure that I can uphold to a higher level of accountability throughout all government departments. So the cabinet secretary and I have had some discussions about that report. I am reaching out to the auditor general And looking for an opportunity to sit down and get some bullet points on what we can do to improve the situation going forward. And this is not something new. I mean, I have had meetings with the Auditor General to see how we can work together.
Sure.
And so that's one part, because we always want to make sure we can improve. The first part about the, you know, follow the money, that is not, in my humble opinion, that is not something that a government should do. That's something that you know, authorities who are concerned about it should do. So if the police want to take a look into that, they can do that. You know, if the auditor makes suggestions about you know, a forensic analysis, that's something that can be looked at it into.
Why isn't it something for government to look into?
Because government is, if you want to follow the money and you know, call people to discipline on that, we are not the police. That's
sure.
not our job. Our government is to run the affairs of the country to our
okay.
best possible way. And I'm sure that authorities will take a look at that in the appropriate way. My job as premier is not to go on a witch hunt on former governments and all that type of stuff. Do I like what was in the report? No, I don't. I've been in business for 35 years, so I've seen my fair share of reports. And I don't like what's gone on in there. And I want to make sure that we don't repeat those challenges. I'll draw the bar up to a higher and higher level all the time. But if there's investigations that have to take place, that's up to authorities who are enshrined in law to do those type of
okay.
things. And I won't stand in the way of those. I'll support them for every
time.
Those
are those questions. So you would support an investigation if one happened?
Appropriate levels about any audit. About any audit. Because as Premier, I stand for the highest level of transparency and accountability. And I think you've seen that. Patty came in a few
yes,
short
yes.
months
mm-hmm.
after I've been there.
Yeah, I've used it.
Yeah. The premier's, we put in the website for travel, all those type of things, right? But I don't want anybody to say at any time that the premier's on a witch hunt about this type of stuff. That's not what politicians are supposed to do.
I have to say, I wouldn't call it a witch hunt, personally. I'd more call it an open investigation, apart from anything else, to find out whether controls went wrong.
Right.
I mean, we have history lessons, so
okay.
we learn from
but
history
we
to
do,
put things right.
But we do have a system in place. Whether some people think it works properly or improperly. The auditor tables the report in the House. The Public Accounts Committee tables the report, discuss it. They can call anybody in for an interview, and then after that, then it can go in a number of different directions. As Premier, I'm not going to short-circuit that approach, because the Public Accounts Committee hasn't even met today to discuss an approach on that report. And remember, in the Public Accounts Committee, both the government and the opposition sit in there. And this is the first time in the history that I can recall where, now, Jeremy, you probably know, but some of your listeners don't know, the Public Accounts Committee, the government have the majority on the committee, but it's chaired by the opposition.
That's right, yeah.
Shadow spokesperson
yeah.
for finance.
Yeah.
So here it is now for the first time is where a report's tabled about a former opposition. It's going to be chaired by a person who was in that. But the government's going to have the majority in it. So that's going to be quite interesting, the approach they take. But I think we should let them do their work before we decide on any other approaches
okay.
that we take.
I totally agree. But I think there's a feeling out there, or maybe it's just my feeling, but there's a feeling perhaps that the Auditor General tables a report, and it's not the first time she's tabled this kind of report. The PAC or me table a report, and then it seems to disappear into a black hole.
Well, I mean, that's your comment, which I don't necessarily support. It's up to the PAC to move it forward. And I'm sure that with the track record of the chairman on his desire to look at things, to have meetings, I don't think he would stop that approach. I fully believe that the opposition member who chairs it, shadow spokesperson for finance, will be very aggressive in looking into it. And I'm sure all members in the committee will support that as well. I don't think we should jump and say that it will fall into a black hole, because I believe people view it with grave concern. They want to get to the bottom of it, and we'll support them. We'll support them doing that.
Can you reassure the public that after the OBA came into power, that better controls were put in place to monitor spending?
I definitely can assure them that. I know. Since my time as Premier, I've tried to do everything I can to make sure the higher level of controls can come in place. I can assure you now that the level of untendered contracts that we saw in there, or contracts didn't come around the cabinet table, are not there anymore. because we spend a lot of time making sure it comes to the cabinet table and we take a look at it. We spend a lot of time going back and making sure that we try to cast net as wide as we can to get people to put in requests for proposals. So we've drastically improved that. And the Minister of Finance has been very adamant about the fact that, wait a second, guys, we're in a hole. Mm. You know, we're spending a lot of money that's not our money, it's borrowed money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to be a higher level of accountability on that. So we've tried to do that. And, you know, unfortunately, with that has come some criticism because people say, well, we're not moving fast enough, or, you know, I didn't get my funding over here, or it's taking too long to get this developed. But I'm sorry, oversight requires time. And that's something I'll keep pushing for.
Talking about overspending, I suppose, kind of leads on to my next question. We had the Sage Commission, and it was met in the blaze of glory, blaze of publicity. And in 2013, again, it's a quote from the Throne speech, government will put forward a plan to implement the Commission's recommendations. What's happened?
Well, there's been a number of reports from that since that time, and we'll keep talking about it. I think it was in the Throne speech as well. The Sage Commission, once it was turned over, those recommendations were put into it. Government considered those, and then we moved on to the next step on public service reform. So at that point, the Sage Commission basically ended, although the report was still a work that we use. The government has mapped out all the recommendations in there. We've taken a look at the ones that we think are worth considering. We've implemented some, and we've put some to the side, which we, you know, at this point in time, we're not interested in.
Right.
The minister did have a public meeting where he laid out some of the suggestions. Mm-hmm. It was met with catcalls by some members in our community.
Yep.
But we still move forward to try to make the changes that we believe are appropriate. So now we still have a very, what I believe to be very appropriate public service reform initiative. It is a subcommittee of cabinet that I chair. We did have a meeting last week on proposals on the way forward. So we're actively moving on a lot of this stuff. But remember, if you're going to make changes, they have to be done with proper consideration and consultation. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to do. Now, some people would like reform to move quicker, or some people have some of their pet projects they'd like to see happen.
No question.
I can't please everybody.
No.
You know, this Throne speech was a very aggressive agenda. There's a lot that we have to do. Unfortunately, I go home a lot of nights and I haven't ticked some of the boxes I want to get done, but wake up tomorrow and we'll move forward on it. Public sector reform is moving forward. We've made progress. If you see the six-month report from government finances that was in the Throne speech, we are where we said we would be for the first 6 months this year. In fact, we're a little bit ahead. Revenues are slightly up. Mm-hmm. So are expenses, but revenues are up much more than expenses are. So we're going in the right direction. But we've had people that have worked against us in that. The unions have expressed their desire to work with us, but it hasn't been as sincere, my choice of words, as I would like to it. So there's been some headwinds. We'll keep going forward, and we'll keep communicating on that.
Just one question, but I'd like to come back to the unions. I know you're a bit pushed for time, but if you're elected for a second term, do you think we might see some more aggressive implementation of the Safe Commission's recommendations? I'm thinking clearly of privatisation of some services.
I think we've been pretty aggressive with our agenda on the people's business all the way through. So, you know, people know they know the way I am. Mm. I'm nonstop from the time I wake up to the time I go to sleep at night. We can't get any more aggressive. I drive cabinet ministers hard, and cabinet ministers are performing about that. So we're going to continue to be aggressive because change takes time and there are too many people struggling in Bermuda, and we want to have a sustainable model within government that works.
Is privatization still on the agenda then?
It's a consideration, but we have many other more important things that we need to take a look at. You know, which government departments are working efficiently, and how can we merge some of them to be more efficient in there? You know, the hiring freeze this year has really started to, I believe, give us a higher level of accountability. We had so many temporary positions before. There was no tracking of government employment and stuff like that. You know, so far in the first 6 months of this year, there have been over 130 positions that have not been renewed because of the hiring freeze. The cabinet secretary has looked at them. I think there were close to 400 positions that became vacant. taking a look at them, see which ones we've needed. We've decided which services we need to keep moving forward. We'll continue to do that exercise, and I think that's going to continue to be a positive exercise for us. And I have to say, Jeremy, I want to take this opportunity to thank the civil servants for working with us. You know, I think people don't realize the strain that you're under when you're under scrutiny about how the department's going to function going forward. And there's a hiring freeze on, so you know, if somebody's contract's on up, it takes some time to get somebody else in the door. Those are strains that I appreciate as an employer, and I want to thank them for that. And we need to continue to have that positive attitude about how we're going to get through things, because we're in a deep hole, and you get dirty when you dig yourself out of a hole.
Absolutely. Speaking of its positive attitude, what's your relationship like with the unions, yours personally and the government?
I wish it was better, but I think the unions have taken a position on some issues that I don't support. I'm only a phone call away from the unions at all times.
Have you met recently? Do you have regular meetings, or has that just stopped?
Look, we haven't had the regular meetings like we would like to have. That's not my doing. That's the unions. They're really concerned about the court action that's taken place.
That's right, yeah.
And the court action is simple. We just want the unions to agree that if there is a grievance, they'll document the grievance with us so we can deal with it. You know, the days of wildcat walkouts and stuff are gone. You know, we have collective bargaining agreements which we will honor until the cows come home. But the wildcat walkouts and all those type of things has got to stop. We live in a different world than that type of stuff. And if they give us our commitment that they'll do things following the collective bargaining agreement, then the legal action disappears. As simple as that.
You've not had that commitment.
Right? And, you know, the unions there's some unions who abide by the letter of the law at all times, and no problem with that. But some of the action that had taken place was not following the collective bargaining agreements, and that's what's got to stop.
Is there a chance that you'll meet around the table anytime?
I'd love to. If any union leader called me right now, I'd set up a meeting at my earliest.
Will you call
them? Happy to, but they've said there's no interest until the court action's dropped.
Right.
We're not dropping something which we believe is right. If all they have to do is come back and say, yeah, we've got these agreements, we'll follow them, no problem. We wouldn't be in court. We wouldn't waste valuable time and resources that we can focus in on something else.
I've got to touch on this one, and I know it's a very sensitive subject, the so-called Jetgate affair. I was quite intrigued when you appointed Craig Cannonier, back to the Cabinet as Minister of Works and Engineering, because I understand it, the police investigation into the affair was still underway there and is still underway now.
Mm-hmm.
What prompted you to do that? It seemed a strange decision.
I appreciate your sentiment. I'm sure there are those in the community who support that. At the time, I felt very confident in Mr. Cannonier's ability. He's always assured me that any issues that there might be in that regard are something that wouldn't impinge or impugn on what he has to do. And so I have confidence in that approach.
Because what the real danger is, perhaps the real danger for you, that if the police investigation does come to any conclusion, that you're going to lose a minister in quite embarrassing circumstances.
Then I'll have to deal with that in the appropriate way. You know, life is not a big fat softball you hit all the time, so there are challenges that come up. And I support any investigation that the police want to do. I have no problem with that.
There has been a suggestion in documents that have been released into the public domain that he was considering crossing the floor. Did that have any bearing on your decision to make him a minister?
No. You know, there have been many members who have crossed the floor over time, and that's up to them. It really hasn't helped any political career. I try to make my decisions based on sound fact, and I'm not worried about people crossing the floor. Minister Cannonier has never expressed any concern to me about the One Bermuda Alliance and the government, so I have no problem with that. We've always had a very close relationship. Minister Cannonier stepped down. And it was very clear why he stepped out at that time. He's always been very open with me about matters, and I take persons on their word.
All right, Premier, thank you very much for your time today. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you. Anytime. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you for tuning in to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com, your 24/7 Bermuda news source.